Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, we're launching a new monthly segment, Mondays with the Mayor. Boston Mayor Marty Walsh is in studio. We're talking education, transportation, housing, policing, all things Boston.
Planning is really about the growth of the city and making sure that the housing is there, making sure that the transportation and infrastructure is there.
Got a question for Mayor Walsh? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. Also today, what does the college admissions scandal tell us about how we view higher education?
That's the way you behave if you feel like you are in a zero-sum game. If you think that higher education is not a collective good, but a consumer good, a scarce commodity, and it's your job to compete for it, for yourself and for your children.
Author Paul Tough on how college makes or breaks us. That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and Boston Mayor Marty Walsh is with us in Studio 3 for a regular check-in. It's a new monthly segment we're calling Mondays with the Mayor. Mayor Walsh, welcome back to Radio Boston.
It's great to be here, and I'm excited about this. We talked about it for a while, and it's a great way to get information out to people and a great way for me to hear from people's concerns. So those are going to call in. You can ask me a question. You can give me an opinion if you have one as well. So I'd like to do that as well. And we have people that listen in the office. So any information that we get, and if you have questions and we can't answer them, we'll take your information and get back to you.
So you heard the mayor. Pick up the phone. Call him. What opinion do you want to share? What question do you have for Boston Mayor Marty Walsh? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. And if you're a Facebook kind of kid, we are also streaming this conversation on Facebook Live. You can find a link at our website, radioboston.org. So call in. Okay, Mayor, I want to start by talking about education. I think you have some news on one of your key programs.
Yeah, our tuition-free community college program that we started in 2016, which was free community college for high school graduates. We started with two schools, Bunker Hill Community College and Roxbury Community College. We expanded that to Mass Bay Community College and Ben Franklin Institute of Technology this school year. We've been able to get 489 students that have been accepted to this program to school since it happened. And today I'm announcing that Massasoit Community College is going to be added to the list. So we're really diversifying. We're getting towards this free college. We're starting with community college, but a lot of conversation in the presidential election. I personally think that college, if we can figure it out, should be accessible to everybody. To put pathway put people on a pathway to college or even a career through programming. So this is really, I'm excited. It's about getting kids into college. It's about getting them in the first couple of years. The requirements are they have to have a 2.0 GPA when they're in college. They have to have a 3.0 GPA. They have to finish their school within 2 years.
Have to be Boston Public High School graduates?
Boston Public High School graduates right now.
And what does Massasoit bring to the table? What will students have access to?
Another option. Full Massasoit College. So what it really does, it does two things. Number one, it will hopefully help these community colleges in their graduation rates. Where in the past, the graduation rates have been kind of low. So in order to get this paid for, you have to graduate. And two, it really opens up doors. Kids that can't either afford to go to a four-year school right now, get them a chance to get the 2 years under their belt and then transfer in. For me, personally, I went to Quincy Junior College for a year after high school because, quite honestly, my grades weren't good. And I was able to realize after going to Quincy Junior for a year that I could do the work. I transferred into Suffolk, dropped out of school, but eventually got my degree at Boston College. So it's a way to, so kids don't feel that, you know, if they can't afford to or get into some of the big schools, well, I'm going to quit. No.
So if you can't immediately walk that traditional four-year path.
Yeah, we want you to go to school. We want you to get in the system. We want you to move forward. You know, it's so important for us to that we don't just educate our kids to 12th grade. We all saw the story in the paper a few months ago about the valedictorians and not having success in the 2007 class and A class. And we really have to work with our kids to help them and some of our kids and a lot of our kids to get them through the system.
So hopefully as you add other community colleges, you'll have more enrollment. So how do you pay for the expansion of this?
It's all through the economic development boom in the city of Boston and the money that we're getting in from the city from new developments. And that's how we're paying for it. And it's giving right back into the community, giving right back to our kids. Our kids are the future workforces for these companies that are moving into our city. And any time we can strengthen their educational system, as well as strengthening our community colleges and Ben Franklin as another one, it's a win-win for everyone.
So that's a key piece of the overall education pipeline.
Yeah.
You've also really prioritized pre-K.
Universal pre-K.
Universal pre-K. You're on track for about 11 years for implementation. We're getting there, but there are cities like New York. So on the other side of the city.
Starting from the day I became mayor.
Right, that's
yes.
Right. That's right. And it looks like it's going to take about 11 years. There are cities that have done it faster.
Four from now. No, about four more years left.
By 2024.
No. What year are we in? 2019.
Well,
yeah, 2024 is the goal. I want to move it up.
Okay. Oh, so how are you going to do that?
I'm pushing the school department.
What do you need from them to be able to move it up?
Really, it comes down to space. Most of it's space and having a program. Let me give you the example between New York and Boston.
Yeah.
When New York created universal pre-kindergarten, the legislature in New York funded it through a grant program. And New York was able to access about $280 million. And they created a program, universal pre-kindergarten, Bill de Blasio's first year as mayor. We went down to New York to see it, and they copied the Boston model as far as pre-kindergarten. What we decided to do was set up a system, high-quality pre-kindergarten first, and then institute it afterwards. And while we're doing, increase our seats every year. So we've increased, since I've been mayor, about 1,000 new pre-kindergarten seats from 2014. But to have universal pre-kindergarten across every four-year-old eligible in the city of Boston, it really is about where do these young people go to school. Building capacity in our schools, and every year we can build more, we're going to, as well as working with the nonprofits to make sure they have high-quality pre-kindergarten. An example of that is the Boys and Girls Clubs of Dorchester, which offers pre-kindergarten now. It'll have to be high-quality. We'll be paying the teachers more, training them more like we train our teachers, and really moving forward. So we went to the legislature trying to get money from the Convention Center Fund. We weren't successful. There's a lot of discussions in Massachusetts about universal pre-kindergarten, but we haven't seen it move forward yet to the degree it should. Pre-kindergarten, we should have it universal in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. It should be universal in the country.
What do you think it'll take to get a yes from the legislature?
Funded it last year in the budget. So we start to build our budget out. So we're not going to wait around now for the legislature. But I do think the legislature has to take a serious look at pre-kindergarten and education as a whole, funding of education, both from pre-kindergarten all the way through college. I think we have to really think about making sure we have the proper investments made in our educational system.
So new superintendent Brenda Casilia, she puts a pause on standardized testing at the beginning of the year. It gives some greater flexibility to schools. What are you hoping the pause is going to achieve? And are you thinking you want to reduce the number of standardized tests through the public schools?
I've talked to the superintendent about that. You know, she's looking at the standardized testing. She's looking at the way we deliver education in the classroom. She's looking at the way we do transportation. She's visited, I think, 90 schools out of the 120 so far, maybe more by now. She's really focused on a plan on continuing moving our district forward. We've had some good gains over the last decade in Boston. Our scores have incrementally gone better. Our scores for two-thirds of our school are performing at high levels in Boston, which means we still have a third of our schools not at high level. So we have to figure out how do we make the investments and how do we make the changes in those bottom one-third percent of our schools. There was a national assessment the other day that showed that there really wasn't a lot of gain from the last time that we had a national assessment. That's concerning in some levels, and in other levels it's I'm not going to focus on the negative. I'm going to say how do we improve our schools. We're making investments in building new schools. We have a couple schools under construction right now. So there's a whole comprehensive plan that Brenda's talked about, and really putting together her strategic master plan. She, you know, we talked about it. I meet with her again this week. I meet with her almost every week to talk about where she is and moving forward. She's working very closely with the school committee and making sure that as we think about this strategic plan, the investments she wants to make to make sure we fund them.
Where would exam schools and the possibility of eliminating admission tests for the exam schools
fit into that? I think that's one of those issues. That's a third rail issue that gets everyone talking about exam schools. And I don't think that's necessarily our issue. Our issue is how do we pull the other 28 high schools we have up to exam school standard? How do we make sure that when parents decide or when kids decide they want it, when they're going to high school, that they have high quality high schools to go to? And I think that we're focused in some cases too much on the exam schools and trying to change the admissions policy, and we're not focusing enough on the 28 high schools that we have and how do we improve those schools.
But if you could improve access to the exam schools in the meantime for more kids of color.
If we can improve the high schools in the meantime, that's what we should do.
So you're not interested in also trying to increase access to the exam schools?
I think Brenda's looking at, we've done a lot with that. We've added prep tests this year. We're changing when I first started as mayor, there was prep for 240 kids. So kids that knew how to access those programs got prep.
The exam prep.
Yeah, you had to go to certain schools to take the exam. 2015-16, I think it was 16, we doubled the number of prep sessions out there. So we're targeting schools to make sure kids that weren't taking the test in certain schools were getting prepped and taking the test. And then this year, the exam school test is actually going to happen in a young person's school. So they're not going to have to travel across the city to get access to that. And we're going to give the test to everybody.
What do you like best about the schools this time of year? Do you get a chance to visit? Do you get a chance to see the kids?
I think there's a lot of great things happening in our schools. And I see the stories and I hear the stories, and it's always kind of a negative slant on our schools. We have some amazing schools in Boston. Ed Vestas did an amazing competition the other day for $110,000 grant for a winner, and there was three unbelievable schools: the Bradley School in East Boston, the Kenny School in Dorchester, and the Harvard Kent School in Charlestown. All three of those schools at one point were underperforming. They're all performing at high levels now. The leadership, the teachers, the parents, the principals, the kids, everyone is excited. And the Harvard Kent won. And for me, it was probably the most difficult competition because I know those three schools very well. And I know that they're unbelievable schools. And there's many others in Boston. And we don't necessarily spend enough time talking or people writing about the good things happening in the school. We're always talking about, you know, the negative stuff. And I think that has an effect on our students and our kids. And, you know, when you think about our district, you know, we have 55,000 kids in our district. About 4,500 are homeless. A third of them come from English is not the primary language in home. Two-thirds come from out of poverty. They have a lot of challenges. And I think that when we're constantly focusing on the negative of it, that has an impact on our students and our teachers. And I think that there's a lot of great things. I'd ask anyone listening, if you want to know what's going on in our schools, go visit a school. Go check it out. See what's going on there. You know, 99% of them, there's amazing things happening in them.
Let's take a call. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. If you'd like to ask Mayor Walsh a question. Matthew from Newton, you are on. What would you like to ask Mayor Marty Walsh?
Yeah, I'd like to know, Mayor Walsh, what progress have you made with the whole body cam issue ever since the Stray Pride Parade? I know that you were interviewed shortly after and you said that you'd follow up and get back to us on it.
Yeah, no. Thank you for the question. There's been a lot of progress. We're in the process right now of instituting the next district with body cameras. It has nothing to do with the Stray Pride Parade, but what we're doing is we're instituting the next district, and by certainly before this time next year, every police officer will have body cameras. We're doing them one district at a time, which means not one station at a time, one district at a time. And the next one's going on now. What happened with in these cameras, this technology, and there's a life of the camera, 8-hour life of the camera, and we've ordered more cameras to have backups now, enough backups for any extra overtime that we have. We didn't have that, and we're instituting a program that is fairly new to Boston. We made a decision to go citywide with it. We made the decision to fast-track it, not do one district every year. We've made the investment in the budget. We're in the process of buying the technology now. Actually, I'm not sure if we're buying it or leasing it, but we're getting the technology now. And then once we have the technology, everyone will have it. The Straight Pride so-called parade, I wouldn't really call it a parade. It was more of a demonstration. We will have if we have parades and things like that next year, we will have the technology for officers to be wearing them.
So WBUR had discovered through public records that none of the officers were wearing body cameras because they were on overtime. Will you now set a policy? Yeah. Will
the
they
extra
wear?
The extra cameras fix that. Okay. So we don't have the extra cameras that have the... have the life, the battery charge on them. So now we will have them.
People who are on overtime will be able to wear have the cameras operational. How is your implementation plan going according to sort of your original schedule? Are you on track?
Yeah, we're on track.
I think at one point you had wanted to be done by the end of October.
Let me find out. I don't have the answer to you when all our officers will have them. I know the equipment's been ordered. We're training officers now with these cameras because you have to train them on the information. I think we're in the process. We either just trained or we're training the next district. I want to say we did C, which is C11 and B3. The next one, I think it's B that we're doing. And then we have A, D, and E.
Okay. There has been some resistance from the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association about body cams.
That was a while ago.
So do you think that is still there?
Listen, that was the head of the unions take a position that they didn't, you know, they didn't agree with us implementing them across the board.
They had a fairly recent newsletter where they said they'd get rid of them.
But it was basically a month ago. And I think that, you know, I appreciate their position. I appreciate them representing their members, feeling they have to do that. But I do think it's important. You know, our motto is to build community trust and relations. I don't think a camera necessarily is the way to build trust, but what it does, if it gives people comfort, then we have it. I think the way you build trust is by old-fashioned communicating with one another. That's what's going to continue to build trust in our city. And I think that's what we have to continue to do.
Let's do some more old-fashioned communicating. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Alex from Brighton, you are on with Mayor Marty Walsh.
Hi.
Hi, Alex.
Hi. I just had a question regarding the body cams. I understand the Boston police officers would be required to wear them, but for example, the Straight Pride Parade, one of the officers that they were looking at for some problems was out of Somerville. Now, if you have officers come from other towns to help, would they be required to wear those cams too?
Great question, and I don't know. Let me check and see that. I don't know that question. That's what Alex is referring to. When we have big events in Boston, sometimes we have to go to other cities and towns and ask for assistance, such as whether it was Straight Pride or if Celtics, Bruins, Patriots, Red Sox win the championship or things like that. On normal parades that we have, like the Pride Parade or, you know, the Evacuation St. Patrick's Day Parade or Torch Today, we don't bring in police officers from other cities and towns. It's when we expect these large numbers of people. I don't have the answer for you, Alex, but I will get it, and I'll make sure that it's transformed on the radio. I can't answer that.
And so give us a sneak view into when you are preparing to collaborate with other communities on big events like the Straight Pride Parade / demonstration. Are you making phone calls to other mayors? Are you talking offline?
No, I'm not. The commissioner is talking. And like same with those organizations, if they have something going on in their city, they'll look for us for help in different areas. It's really run through the police department, the commissioner, and the different chiefs around the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. I prefer if we could do it with our own force, but what's really important for us when we have an event in town, whether it's the Pride or not the Pride Parade, the Good Pride Parade, the other parade, we have to make sure the districts are covered as well. So I'll give you an example, 4th of July. When 4th of July is happening in Boston, we assist the state police on making sure the celebration on the Esplanade in downtown is protected. But we also make sure that we have a full complement of police officers in the neighborhood. We'll never put public safety in jeopardy in our neighborhoods. In any case where we might need to bring other officers in to help us with an event in Boston, we will reach out to them to make sure that we have full coverage throughout the city.
So while we're on police, I do want to ask you, a little over a week ago, BUR reported on a lot of communication between Boston Police and ICE. Specifically, there was an officer whose job was to be a liaison to ICE. Yeah. He's been moved out of that role. You said you were troubled by the emails and you'd look into the relationship. What kinds of questions are you asking? What answers are you getting on that?
Yeah, no, I'm certainly, when there was a couple situations about 6 months ago, or maybe a little more or less than 6 months ago, on a particular case where there was an undocumented worker working for a company, and he was went on an injury leave, and somehow...
We reported on that.
Yeah, you reported the company... basically contacted somebody in the company, contacted the police officer who contacted our liaison in ICE and in the Boston Police Department that deals with the federal government, and they end up picking this person up. That's not our job. Our job is not to enforce federal immigration law. If there is the relationship between the federal government and the Boston Police Department is to make sure that people in Boston are safe. If there are any serious people, criminals out there doing criminal activity, you know, homicides, human trafficking, you know, drug dealing, gun running, we will work very closely with anyone to make sure that our residents in Boston are safe. If there's simple, you know, a car stop or somebody who, you know, does something for whatever reason it is, our job is not to enforce immigration law.
Will this make you reconsider that 2014 contract with ICE at all?
No, it's a very different situation. It's important to make sure that the people of Boston are safe. Sharing information and gathering information, really more than sharing information, is something that is important for us to do. You know, in 2015, there was a suspected terrorist that was going, a relationship between the federal government and the Boston Police Department, and they were able to find out there was some information going on there and to make sure that people were safe. So we're not, you know, again, our job is not to enforce immigration law. Our job is to make sure to keep the people of Boston safe.
Is there anything you would want to change about the Trust Act?
The Trust Act that is now in the City Council that we're trying to pass would have prevented a lot of what was in these emails that we saw, would have prevented it.
All right. Let's take a few more calls because the lines are full. Let me just read this out first. We just got a statement from Boston Police that all districts now have body cams. They still need to equip the specialized units, but they all have them.
Good. Thank you. Thanks, Police Department. I wasn't sure, so I'm glad you did that.
Okay. And let's just take a couple of calls. Doug, you are on the line from Concord with Mayor Marty Walsh.
Hi, Mayor. Question for you. Back to education. I grew up with ADD. My son has got Asperger's. A lot of these kids, if they're not treated the right way, end up in confrontations with police, get into bad situations, and can really ruin their lives. And I think that they may need some extra help so they don't get into that kind of confrontation that can really, really ruin their future. Are there any programs that you're working on to target special need kids, you know, predominantly boys with ADHD and autism and kind of get them into a different environment?
Thanks, Doug. Let's turn to the mayor.
The first thing we're trying to do, Doug, is even train our police officers a little more to see any signs that might be out there. I'm drawing a blank right now. There was a situation that was just recently in the newspaper or in the press. I read somewhere about a young man. I think he had autism and the police didn't realize it. It'll come to me in a minute, or somebody will listen and re-email it in. But we're trying to train the police officer to be more cognizant of that, to be able to see signs that might be there, that if a young person they come across, for whatever reason, they realize that the young person needs to be treated and dealt with in a different manner. Second piece is some of our our education going on in our schools, our different schools in the city of Boston, working with our young people as well. And we're building relations. We bring our police department into many of our schools, our high schools, to work with you know, role playing, you know, interactions between young people and police officers and how to approach it, how not to approach it. And we do that on a fairly regular basis. And the commissioner created something called the Bureau of Community Engagement, that we have a superintendent now and officers within that bureau, that their primary job is to go out and continue to build relations. And that's, when I say relations, that's in all communities, including young people that have you know, whether it's Asperger's or Down syndrome or other issues that young people are dealing with, as well as educating the officers on how to deal with it.
Let's take one more call before we go to a break. Beth from the South End, you are on the line with Mayor Marty Walsh.
Hi, Mayor. Thank you for all you do for the city.
Thanks, Beth.
I'm a teacher in the city. How are you? I'm a teacher in the South End, and you know, given all that we know about the opioid epidemic and relationships, building relationships with our minority population and, you know, the police department and everything. I grew up in the 80s and 90s when we had the DARE program.
Did you say DARE, Beth?
Yeah.
DARE,
yeah, it's the acronym D-A-R-E.
Yep.
And I just feel like that is just missing in the public schools. you know, the respect for the police. You know, I wanted to be a police officer. Seeing the police come in, you know, it was always a real highlight of my day. And just obviously the drug component is huge. And so, I just wondered, you know, why doesn't Boston have that? Like, what's going on?
Great. Let's turn that over to the mayor.
Let me jump. There's two things that you talked about there, and I'm glad you brought it. The relationship between young people, particularly young people of color, in the police department, sometimes when I say young people, teenagers, we lose that relationship. We do a really good job at a very, very young age of building relations and trust. We do a good job again when people get older, but somehow in that adolescent stage, we have a break there, and we have some work to do there on the DARE stuff. Studies show that the DARE programs didn't work. And with addiction. And what we really have to do is go younger and more education around drug addiction and what it means on pills and marijuana and all the other issues that come up with, and drinking, quite honestly, and smoking and vaping and all the other things that are out there, and the impacts that it has on a young person's mind and their brain. We have been doing some of that in our schools. We're working with our public health department, working with the state public health department to try and come up with better programming. There's a whole bunch in that question you asked me that I could probably spend a whole hour on talking about.
Well, after we take a break, we could talk more about addiction as well.
Yeah, real quick. Parents that are listening on the radio, don't be afraid to have a conversation with your kids about drugs. You have to, because it's just such a complex issue.
Okay, before we go to break, let's have a little fun. Did you dress up for Halloween?
No, I didn't, but I had some amazing people, young people, come to my house in amazing costumes. It was awesome. They were great.
Any particular favorites?
I had a young woman. She was about 4. Came out to me, and I said, "Oh my God, Batgirl!" And she goes, "I'm Batkid." And I loved it. She was awesome.
Excellent. All right, listen, listeners, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk transportation, addiction, and a number of other subjects. Keep calling in. Mayor Marty Walsh, please don't go anywhere. We're going to take a quick break. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we are still here in Studio 3 with Boston Mayor Marty Walsh. Mayor, thanks for sticking with us.
Thank you.
Listeners, keep calling. The mayor's here to take your questions or hear your comments. You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or you can send us a tweet at Radio Boston. We're also streaming this conversation on Facebook Live. You can find a link to that on our website, radioboston.org. Let's talk transportation for a minute. Last week on Friday, you had a milestone on your Go 2030 transportation plan. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, what we're doing is we have 21, we identified 58 projects, and we're in 21 of them out of the 58 are under implementation. There's another 17 that are in design. And I just want to read some of the things that we're doing. We're working on bike share network expansion with nearly 2 million trips a year, 100 new stations in the city of Boston. Those are the blue bikes that we're seeing. So we're seeing a lot more people use the bikes. Better bike corridors, 8 miles of projected bike lanes have been installed with 10 miles in construction and planning right now. So we're looking really at how do we, because that's one of the biggest concerns people have with me is that, you know, they feel like we're not moving quick enough and fast enough. But we're dealing with an infrastructure as well. So we're getting, you know, we'll have 18 miles of infrastructure that the city's built out in the last 5 years. We're working on neighborhood slow streets. We have 5 zones in design. What does that mean? That means the community gets together and talks about areas that traffic is going too fast. So how do we redesign? One of those areas is working with the state on Gallivan Boulevard, where they're redesigning the intersections as we move forward. Forest Hills to Rosendale Rapid Bus service. We're working completion of the inbound lane. We're working to bring more rapid bus lanes, dedicated bus lanes to Boston and to our neighborhoods. And also fair MBTA fare policy and extended hours. We worked with the MBTA not to raise fares on seniors and young people. We expanded our MBTA passes 10 months a year to all high school age, 7th through 12th grade young people in the city of Boston. And it's constant moving forward. I was in Copenhagen 2 weeks ago, and I really saw some amazing network of bikes. And there was a story in the Herald today about how some people in West Roxbury don't want dedicated bike lanes. And I think that I ask everyone, just bear with us and work through a process. I know that nobody likes change, and I think if there's an opportunity for us to explain why you want to do something, it'll work out in the end of the day. And
why do you think dedicated bike lanes is a tense issue, that there are strong advocates?
It's a change. I think it's a change. You know, when I was in Copenhagen, 50% of the people that go to work every day take a bike, and they have amazing infrastructure there, and everyone follows the signals. When the lights are red, everyone stops. When the lights are green, everyone goes. When the walk sign is red, people don't walk. No jaywalking, no running across, and there really is a respect for the road and the rules of the road, and I think that's been built up over decades. And I think here in Boston, I mean, people feel bicyclists are in the way and cars are in the way, and there isn't bike transportation is coming. And in the future of Massachusetts, by the year 2030 in Boston, I think we want to have 35% of the people taking bikes to work. So there's an opportunity for us here. And I think I ask people just to be patient, work with us, listen to the conversations. It's not the end of the world, and the sky's not going to fall in, and there's an opportunity. And there's a lot of people, I think if they had the chance to take a bike to work, they would take the bike to work. It's better for the environment. It would cut down on traffic. If you're in the car and you want to drive, you'll have less cars on the road. And if the infrastructure's there, there's a system that works that's safe. And I think for bicyclists, it's really important for us to make sure that the roads remain safe for them.
Let's take a call. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Jeffrey from Jamaica Plain. Go ahead.
Hi, Mayor. It's Jeffrey Ferris.
Jeff, how are you? Are you?
Good, thank you. You know me as owner of Ferris Wheels Bicycle Shop.
Oh, yeah. How are you?
Along with that for 37 years, we also have a winter snow shoveling business to complement the seasons. And we do a lot of businesses and commercial spaces, the Loring Granite House, along Center Street and South Street, streets that have the, no parking during big storms. And there's a problem. I've been trying to address this for years with various people in public works, your administration and before. And I've been out there in the middle of the night watching this happen. And near the end of this storm, your large city trucks, I'm not talking the contractors, I'm talking about Boston.
Jeff, I need you to get to the question here, can you?
Yes, I'm getting there, yes. The big ones come barreling down the street at like 30 miles an hour, and they throw all their slop up and over the sidewalks, many of which have already been cleared. And it's that, it's a lot harder than go clear it. I've had clients ticketed for snow that the plows put on it, where we already cleared the sidewalk.
All right, let's give the mayor a chance to answer, Jeff. I'm going to turn it back over to you.
I get the point, Jeff. I hear it a lot. The hard part about that is that depending on the snow and the longevity of the storm, how long it goes for, if we can get the streets clear, for example, the best snowstorm we get is at night. Because we can clear the snow when people get up in the morning and clear the sidewalks, the snow's done, the streets are clean, and there's really not going to be a lot of plowing that's going to go on to push snow back on the street. And it really comes down. It's a complicated situation. What I'm going to do, if you're still on the line, if you could stay on the line, if not, give Chris Osgood a call, and let's see if there's something that we can work out in certain parts of the city of Boston where that becomes a big issue.
All right.
Real quickly, Alex, when Alex called in earlier, I got information. This is on the body cameras of other cities and towns that they'd be required to wear them. It would be up to each individual city or town to determine if their officers would be required to wear body cameras while assisting us with a Boston event. So it's really up to the cities and towns
to make those decisions. Let's take another call. We've got Donna from Dorchester. You are on the line with Mayor Walsh. Donna, you there?
Hello. Yes.
Hi, go ahead, Donna.
Okay, I was born in Boston, and I think that what makes Boston so special opposed to other cities around the country is its neighborhoods. And my concern is that the neighborhoods are being destroyed one at a time by the developers. And I want to ask, because we voted for you thinking that you were going to be an advocate for the neighborhoods, and I don't understand why the developers have taken over the city.
Let's turn to the mayor for that, Donna.
I don't think I would assess that the developers have taken over the city. They certainly haven't. I am a neighborhood guy. I grew up in Dorchester. I grew up in St. Margaret's Parish, the section of Dorchester. I'm proud of that. I live in Lower Mills now. I lived in Savin Hill. The strength of our community is our neighborhoods. I think that they've changed over the years because we have a lot of new people that live in Boston that don't necessarily have the history of associating themselves with growing up on a certain corner in a certain park in a certain neighborhood like I did and many of us listening on the radio. But I wouldn't say that developers have taken over the neighborhood. We're certainly looking in areas. We're planning now, and we're looking in East Boston, where a lot of development has happened in East Boston. When I was running for mayor in 2013, people wanted to see development in East Boston. Now, 2019, people are tired of it. So we certainly are keeping an eye on what's happening in our neighborhoods. We don't want to lose the fabric.
Are you worried about gentrification?
Well, that's why we came up with a housing plan. We came up with a housing plan to build more housing. I mean, I think gentrification is something that, you know, what happens is if a neighborhood loses a housing stock or families can't afford to live there, it changes.
And that is happening.
It's changed in Boston for the last 100 years. Every neighborhood's different than it has been the years before that. But I'm not justifying that. My point is that we have a housing plan to create 69,000 units of new housing by the year 2030. We've created 31,000 units of housing, 6,800 of those low-income housing. We're going to continue to build more housing. Boston is a very popular city right now. We have people coming, wanting to move here. Where 10 years ago, people weren't picking Boston as the place when they graduated college. They were going to Silicon Valley. They were going to New York. Now they're coming to Boston. Baby boomers that moved out of Boston in the 70s and 80s are moving into the city of Boston. You have people that grew up in the city want to stay here, and you have all these millennials that have graduated college and want to stay here. We have these companies that are investing here in Boston and growing in the city. So it's a very – we didn't have – when I said this, when I took over as mayor in 2014, we were growing as a city and we didn't have a housing plan. And we're doing a little bit of catch-up now by creating a housing plan. Same thing with transportation. We didn't have a full transportation plan. You know, we have to continue to build out our transportation network, our transportation system. So a lot of this stuff that's happening is because of the success of our growth, but it's also straining our quality of life.
This year is this week is the 25th anniversary of the removal of rent control in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Yep. There is some discussion on Beacon Hill about whether or not that should come back. What's your position on rent control?
I mean, it's not a simple 25 years ago, rent control was very different than what's being discussed today. And today, there's a lot of different pieces of legislation at the State House, and in the state of California did something where people could have incremental growth in raising rents. And I think that we have to have a full discussion on what exactly is the right situation for us here in Boston. I think that, you know, in some cases, people say rent control worked. And other people say, I was at an event the other day, and people said, you know, rent control didn't help us because the landlords didn't make investments in the housing. So I think that certainly we're working on a whole host of bills, right to representation in court. And we also have another bill for not to be able to displace and raise large amounts of rent on seniors over 75. So, we need to have every conversation is worth having.
All right. You going to come back again next month? Will we get you on a Monday in December?
I will.
Excellent. That is Boston Mayor Marty Walsh. Mayor Walsh, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Hey, stay with us. Coming up, we'll talk to author Paul Tough about his new book, The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes or Breaks Us. That's coming up after a break. Stay with us. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. If you are a parent like me, of a high school senior or junior, you probably know exactly what I mean when I say admissions anxiety. I am gripping the table as I say it. Parents have nightmares about it. Student applicants carry it around every day like the weight of an extra backpack. But what if that anxiety isn't just about getting in, but is actually a sign of a bigger problem plaguing higher education? Joining me here in Studio 3 to explore that question is Paul Tough. He's a journalist, writer, and author of the new book, The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes or Breaks Us. Paul, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So I want to start with a quick reading, actually, from the book, if that's okay. It's actually from the first chapter. You're meeting with a high school student, Shannon Torres. She's a low-income student from New York City who's waiting to hear whether or not she's been accepted to her dream school at Penn.
Yeah, so we're sitting together on a bench in West Harlem, and she's going to get the news in the next half hour or so. So I'll read now from that chapter. Shannon had begun crying for real now, quietly, swiping her fingers up under her glasses to catch the tears before they fell. I asked her why she was so upset even before she had received any news, good or bad, and she said she wasn't sure, but she tried to explain. School has always been my thing, she said slowly. I've been working so hard for the past... How long have I been in school? I've been in school since I was 3. She rubbed her nose on the sleeve of her hoodie. So you take the thing that you've been best at your entire life, and you have someone, or in this case, a group of people sitting in a circle who have not met you personally who are determining if you're deserving. Shannon could picture them there in the Penn admissions department, paging through her application, her grades and her test scores and her essay and her recommendation letters, and rendering a judgment on who they thought she really was. And then they tell you that it's not enough, or that it's not good enough, she said, or that someone's score on a test could possibly measure up to all those years of hard work that you put yourself through, that you chose to put yourself through. Now she was crying harder. And I did choose it. I love school. I love what I do. It's something that I don't force myself to do. I come to school because it's me. It's just who I am.
So I had you start with that probably for the same reason you started with it, opening the book. You can really feel the anxiety and the tremendous pressure that this poor kid, Shannon, is dealing with from herself, friends, family, teachers. We're not going to reveal what happens to her, whether or not she gets into Penn. But were you surprised at the impact that she was experiencing, you know, in that moment?
In some ways, I was. Yeah. I mean, it was a gripping moment to be with her, and I was grateful to her for sharing that moment with me. But I, at the same time, I'd known Shannon at this point for a while. I'd met her a few other times, and I knew how much pressure she had put on herself and the system had put on her for this decision to go the right way. You know, I think there is definitely a psychological pressure that students, all sorts of students, but especially students from low-income families can put on themselves in this situation. But I think she was also responding to some very real pressures in the economy. You know, for a student like her, first-generation student, no one in her family had gone to college, from a low-income, single-parent family in the South Bronx, for her to get admission to one of these selective colleges would change her life, would give her opportunities beyond what she could imagine. And I think the way she felt was that for young people like her from her corner of the South Bronx, you don't get a lot of second chances. This was her one shot.
You know, one of the things that I struggled with in reading the book was we all know the script. We know what we're supposed to say. We are supposed to say, isn't just about getting in. You know, wherever you go, you're going to be great. You know, this is all going to be fine. You're going to go to college. But you say not exactly true. And you talk about some really high stakes, not just about whether you get in, but where you go.
Yeah, that was how it felt for me. So I was sitting there with her on the bench, and I wanted to give her that sort of reassuring message. And I think it's important to say that for high-income students, for affluent students, where you go matters a whole lot less. But I had just come back on the day that I was sitting there with Shannon from California, where I'd spent a few days embedded in the lab of an economist then at Stanford, now at Harvard, named Raj Chetty, who, along with his colleagues, had done this remarkable study called the Mobility Report Card Study.
Part of his Equality of Opportunity Project.
Exactly. That demonstrated for the first time with you know, clear data how much of a difference going to a highly selective institution matters.
And now, when you say a difference, what kind of difference?
Well, so one data point that he found is for students who go to what he calls Ivy Plus institutions, meaning the Ivy League and other similarly selective colleges, students who go to those institutions have a 1 in 5 chance of being in early adulthood in the top 1% of earners, of getting really rich pretty quickly. And students at colleges just one step down, the super selective colleges that aren't quite in the Ivy League, they have a 1 in 11 chance, almost half as much of a chance. And students who go to community college, a 1 in 300 chance. So that selectivity matters, and it especially matters for low-income students. Another finding of Raj Chetty's is that when two students from very different backgrounds go to the same institution, the gap between them almost entirely disappears just in those 4 years. And in early adulthood, they're earning almost exactly the same amount.
So does that put special responsibility on the most elite institutions to admit more low-income students, make it more possible to go to school? What's our moral burden here? If we know that information is true, what is our systemic obligation here?
Well, you would think that they would feel that moral obligation. But the third finding that Raj and his colleagues came up with is that these highly selective institutions are admitting very few students like Shannon. So
why?
At Ivy Plus institutions, almost 3/4 of students are from the top economic quintile, and just 2 or 3 or 4% are from the bottom economic
quintile. Is that all
quintile.
Just about ability to pay?
I think at those institutions, it's not as much about ability to pay because they have these enormous endowments that they can admit anybody they want. I think it is about it's partly about their focus on test scores, and test scores correlate highly with family income, much more so than high school GPA. If you are judging students only by their test scores, you're going to admit a class like these schools do that has a lot more high income students and a lot fewer low income students. There are other advantages, certainly ability to pay tuition, early decision. There are lots of points in the admission system that favor high-income students over low-income students.
So you had some discussion of test scores in the book, ACT, SAT, and you actually talked to somebody who was paid basically $400 an hour to help kids do test prep, and he doesn't really do test prep, right?
Yeah.
So that was surprising.
Yeah.
What's going on there, and what was he doing instead?
So this is Ned Johnson, who runs his own test prep company in Washington, D.C., called Prep Matters. He's the most sought-after tutor in the D.C. area. And yeah, so for $400 an hour, when I spent a lot of time following him around and watching his testing, his tutoring sessions, and I had this idea that he was just going to be stuffing these kids' heads with as much, you know, algebra and trigonometry as he possibly could. But in fact, he was talking to them much more about stress. And his theory is that when you are the kind of student who would end up in his office, you're going to an excellent school, you have highly educated parents, you have lots of resources, and what's holding you back from getting the test scores you think you need is not a lack of knowledge. It is the anxiety that you feel about this test. A lot of young people, the system trains them to feel that this test is not just something that's going to make or break their future, but it's a measure of their actual self-worth. It's a real, it's a vote on who they are. And so what he does is tries to convince them of the opposite, that these tests are these ridiculous little games. He shows them tricks to, you know, improve their scores.
But you just said they are true, right? I mean, he's trying to convince them the opposite of what your book says is actually true.
I mean, I feel like what he is arguing is that it is the system certainly puts a lot of emphasis on those tests, but that the tests themselves don't measure something important. So, you know, he says it's a corrupt system and he understands his role in that system. But he says that if you understand that it's a game, if you understand that you can improve your score by hundreds of points by getting the kind of tutoring that he provides, it doesn't make you believe in the system anymore because you understand that it is, you know, very malleable, very affected by things like test prep. But you stop thinking that it's actually a measure of who you are. I think that puts other kinds of pressure on those affluent students who then start feeling like, well, I'm getting into these schools based not on my own merit, but on the fact that my parents can pay for Ned. And so I think that that is a different kind of stress that they feel, but it's not the kind of stress that Shannon feels.
We talked a lot of numbers so far, and actually I'm going to come back to the numbers in a minute. But in the meantime, really the most compelling parts of the book are where you tell stories. Like Shannon's story, there's a number of stories in that book. What surprised you as you had those conversations, and what were the big takeaways for you?
I felt really honored that these young people would share so much of their stories with me. And I mean, I think the thing that each story was different, but I think the common takeaway for me was how much young people's feelings about their family and experience of their family was tied up in their feelings about college. I think this is especially true for low-income students, for first-generation students. Going away, especially to a selective institution, if no one in your family has gone to college before, it is just a jarring, strange experience. And it's strange for you, and it's strange for your family as well. You are sort of by necessity when you're experiencing this social mobility. You know, it might be good for you financially, but it's hard to leave behind your family and your culture and your community. And your history, and you're sort of forced in a way that high-income students aren't when they go to selective institutions to encounter a whole new world. And that can lead to great opportunities, but it's really jarring as well.
So you don't know this, but you and I have had an argument. And the reason you don't know it is it was all in my head when I was reading the book. But the thing we were having an argument about is you make the case that these elite institutions are important based on future earnings.
Mm-hmm.
And the piece that I was arguing with you in my head, but we form our children for so much more than that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we educate them and we send them away for life experiences. Are we poor in our metrics of what it means to get a higher education and how we value who we our children then go out to be in the world if we're looking so exclusively at income.
For sure. I mean, I ended up with two very different sorts of feelings. I mean, one was on a personal level, spending time at these institutions and looking at this data did not make me particularly eager to have my kids, who are only 4 and 10, so this is a long way off, to have them attend one of these most selective institutions. I feel like what they would gain in the amount that the institution would invest in them, they would lose in being in such an undiverse and elitist kind of institution. The place where I felt much more at home and much more inspired by what I was seeing around me was in public institutions, especially the University of Texas at Austin, where I spent more time than anywhere else. So I do think that there's a lot else that parents and students should take into account when they're choosing institutions. At the same time, though, I think that these institutions on a social level, these institutions are enormously important as creators of opportunity. And the fact right now that they are so dominated by families and children who already have such privileges and such advantages and so many family resources is a real social problem. And so the fact that MIDS students are going to those schools in such numbers and students like Shannon, who are every bit as deserving, every bit as smart, every bit as hardworking, are going in such small numbers is a real problem that we need to correct.
All right. That is Paul Tuth, journalist, writer, and author of the new book, The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes or Breaks Us. Paul, thank you for being here.
Thanks very much.
That is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Jamie Bologna, and Walter Withman. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi, and I'm Tiziana Deering. And we hope you will join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.